ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Jason will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
Welcome to ETF Prime, Nate Geraci alongside Jason Lenk. As always, thank you so much for joining us. Nice show for you today. On the program will be Sean O'Hara, president of Pacer ETFs Distributors. And this will be good timing with Sean because Pacer is probably best known for their Trendpilot ETFs. So these use trend following to determine whether or not to be invested in the market. And currently, all four of their Trendpilot ETFs are 100% in cash, 100% in T-bills. So these things look at the 200-day moving average to decide whether or not to be fully invested in stocks. They have three U.S. stock ETFs and then one European stock ETF. But the basic idea here is that winners keep winning and losers keep losing, right? Follow the trend. And so if the market begins rolling over like we saw in October, these ETFs provide a risk management strategy to help avoid additional big losses in the event the market were to keep declining. Now, of course, the flip side of that is if we have a week like we did last week where the S&P 500 was up nearly 5%, you miss that if these things are 100% in cash. The trend has to be reestablished before you get back into the market. So there are pros and cons here, but over the long term, the idea is that you avoid big down moves and still capture the bulk of the upside. Jason, this will be an interesting discussion with Sean. Again, I think perfect timing given the market environment right now.
Absolutely. Timing is everything with muted returns this year and the return of volatility. You know, trend following strategies have come into the spotlight. And there are some advantages to using a strategy like this at the ETF level rather than the trading or account level, doing things behind the scenes. But you're right. There are some cons. The term that is most used often is whipsaw. If you're in the price, so to speak, for avoiding huge drawdowns, is that occasionally you'll miss some of the upside. So that upside downside capture, you're looking for a positive number there. So excellent discussion. This is very timely.
Now, later in the show, ETF.com's Dave Noddig will also join us. The topic will be bonds and bond ETFs. Again, perfect timing when you look at what's going on with the yield curve right now. But we'll talk bond ETF flows, active management in bonds. We'll discuss some of these concerns over triple B rated corporate debt that are out there. We'll talk leveraged loan ETFs. We'll cover as much ground as we can in what has been a very challenging area of the market this year. Most areas of the bond market are negative. So Dave will join us in the back half of the program. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com or you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci. All right, let's start today with our market update.
Now it's time for the market update, where we bring you what you need to know from financial markets around the globe.
All right, so we're going to focus on stocks and sprinkle in a little Bitcoin as well. We'll talk bonds later with Dave. First, let me run through some returns this year. So these are all through the end of November. The Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, is now up a little less than 5%, with just about all of that, again, coming last week, which was the best week for stocks since 2011. Prior to that, U.S. stocks had actually turned negative for the year a couple of weeks ago. The Vanguard FTSE Developed Markets ETF, VEA, so developed international stocks, that's down close to 10% on the year. And emerging market stocks, I'll use the Schwab Emerging Markets Equity ETF, SEHE, that's down 11%. And then looking at a few basic alternative assets, the Vanguard Real Estate ETF, VNQ, is up about 2%. The iShares Gold Trust, IAU, that's down over 6%. And broad commodities, PDBC, is also down over 9%. A lot of that driven by oil's decline. And then lastly, Bitcoin, which we'll talk more about here in a few minutes, that's down over 70%. So, Jason, there was this article in the Wall Street Journal last week where they had a chart from Deutsche Bank showing that 90% of the 70 asset classes they track are posting negative returns this year. Now, that was through mid-November, so it did not include last week's big gains or the gains we saw yesterday. But I wanted to talk about this because that's the highest percentage they have on record. And their data goes back all the way to 1901. If you compare that to last year, just 1% of asset classes had negative returns. And the Wall Street Journal noted the possibility of global stocks and bonds finishing negative together for the first time in at least 25 years. Now, we'll see what happens the rest of the year, right? We had dovish comments from the Fed last week. We'll talk about that in a minute. We also had the trade developments with China over the weekend, which were, I think, initially construed as a positive. But overall, it's been an odd year, in one where I don't think most investors are feeling great about things, despite U.S. stocks being up here recently.
Some of the discussion I hear really from money managers worldwide is, where do you go? You know, what's with everything flat to negative, except a few little bright spots, it's been very difficult for active managers and really all investors. It's, I just want to call it, you're right, that angst, that's certainly a conundrum. If you just saw all the numbers, the returns, you'd think the planet was hit by an asteroid. But that's really not the case. Maybe we're late in the business cycle, but corporations are profitable. Margins are at record highs.
Well, again, the S&P 500 is up 5-6%.
Absolutely. And now, you know, with notwithstanding the comments from the Fed and their actions, interest rates are low on a historical basis. And unemployment, you know, we haven't seen this low unemployment in decades. I just wouldn't call that bloodbath conditions. So there's just a disconnect in some regard between performance and some of the metrics out
and
there.
And I think a lot of that is probably just stands in stark contrast to 17. Where,
low
again,
volatility.
We had no volatility. Everything was up.
Absolutely. You know, as I have conversations, the two of the repeated themes that I hear in my conversations are perhaps the inequality of the economic recovery. You know, we are 8, 9, 10 years into this, and certainly the rich have gotten richer. Has everybody prospered to the same extent? I think there's some concern there. But really, the question that serious investors are grappling with is the perceived Fed put still in place?
Well, let's talk more about that, because we've had President Trump tweeting about the Fed and their impact on the markets. There are plenty of investors who believe the sole reason we've had a bull market like we've had is because of the Fed. And really, you can just look back to last week. We saw these comments from Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell on interest rates on Wednesday, which sparked the big up move in stocks. I actually pulled a clip of those comments. Take a listen to this.
For 7 years during the crisis and its painful aftermath, the FOMC kept our policy interest rate unprecedentedly low, in fact, near zero, to support the economy as it struggled to recover. The health of the economy gradually but steadily improved, and about 3 years ago, the FOMC judged that the interests of households and businesses, of savers and borrowers, were no longer best served by such extraordinarily low rates. We therefore began to raise our policy rate gradually toward levels that are more normal in a healthy economy. Interest rates are still low by historical standards, and they remain just below the range of estimates of that level that would be neutral for the economy, that is, neither speeding up nor slowing down growth.
All right, so the kicker there was at the end. He said the Fed was just below the level that would be neutral for the economy. And that's important because it implies the Fed may slow down or even cease raising interest rates, right? So expectations are for a rate hike in December. But then as you look out into 2019, it gets pretty murky. But you know, Jason, interestingly, just in October, Powell said the Fed was still a long way from neutral. And so, you know, combined with the comments last week, I think that got the tinfoil hat crowd kicked into gear. And there were two sort of main narratives I saw, either that A, Powell was appeasing President Trump who again has complained about the Fed being too aggressive, or then B, I saw a take that there's some game theory here that Powell was essentially trying to remove the Fed as a you know, an excuse for Trump in terms of the market and trying to get him to focus on a deal with China and resolve trade issues. The thought being that if the Fed couldn't be blamed for the market's decline, you know, Trump would have to take responsibility. Again, this is the tinfoil hat crowd. But, you know, who knows with this stuff? But look, you know, President Trump did seem to play ball with China this weekend. But, you know, these comments were interesting, you know, saying that just below the level, it would be neutral for the economy.
You're certainly, you know, conspiracy theorists that will, you know, rattle off all kinds of ideas. I've heard the Fed speak to the point that they're data dependent and there's no predetermined path. So, you know, if the facts change and they're changing their analysis, I kind of appreciate that there's some logic to that. They're not a slave to the Phillips curve or any predetermined model. One of the things that's not really talked about, I think that's also having effect is that QE is rolling off. You know, the Fed's balance sheet is shrinking. I think the last figure I heard around $50 billion a month. And so when you remove liquidity from the marketplace, it has an effect, the same way that rising interest rate may have an effect. You mentioned Trump tweeting about, you know, kind of jawboning the Fed a little bit. What's interesting about that is that that's not unprecedented for an administration to behind the scenes, you know, do a little arm twisting or make their case. What's different today is that it's on the Twitter sphere.
That's right. It's out there.
Absolutely. It's out there. So, you know, it's bare bones, knuckled jawboning from the president.
Well, one thing Powell said last week was that the Fed did not see dangerous excesses in stocks. So I think take that for what it's worth, though he did say valuations around higher risk corporate bonds were a concern. And we can talk more about that with Dave Nodig later. But, you know, this cat and mouse game with the president and the Fed and then just how the Fed navigates the economy, I think this is going to be fascinating to watch, you know, over the next year or so. All right, we need to take a break. I do want to briefly touch on Bitcoin and cryptos. This has to be, you know, the one story that keeps on giving. So listen to this. The total market cap for all cryptocurrencies is around $130 billion. That was over $800 billion just back in January. And Bitcoin itself is currently trading around $3,800 last I checked. It began the year around $14,000. And of course, last December, it hit nearly $20,000. And, you know, Jason, I'm bringing this up because we get asked all the time about Bitcoin ETFs, when there will be one. And last week, SEC Chairman Jay Clayton was at a crypto conference where he made some comments on a potential Bitcoin ETF, basically saying the SEC still had concerns about fraud and manipulation in the underlying spot market, along with concerns over the custody or storing of Bitcoin. Listen to these comments from an interview he did with CNBC's Bob Pisani.
Bitcoin ETFs, a lot of people chomping out the bits. I've covered ETFs for a long time. A lot of issuers are waiting. What criteria do you need to start a Bitcoin ETF? We now have a very fairly well-developed futures Bitcoin market that's been out 6 months now. Are you pleased with how that is going? Is the development of that market sufficient to allow Bitcoin ETFs, or are there other criteria?
So, Bob, our Division of Investment Management has put out and been very clear with the industry about the types of things that we're going to need in any asset class if we're going to approve a product. And one of those things is, you know, is the pricing something that people can rely on? Also, asset verification. And our communication to the marketplace on this has been very clear.
All right, so you heard him talking there about whether the underlying prices of digital assets were something investors can rely on, and then asset verification, right, making sure the digital assets are actually there and stored properly. Jason, I know you're a bit fatigued on the whole Bitcoin ETF thing, but again, we do get questions on this. And it was interesting. It seemed like there was some debate, especially on social media, over whether Jay Clayton's comments were good or bad for the prospects of a Bitcoin ETF. My take was, you know, the SEC certainly seems engaged and is becoming much more educated on this topic, which I think without question is good. But you really can't get a warm and fuzzy that a Bitcoin ETF is going to be approved anytime soon when you hear comments like that. And layer on top of that, Bitcoin being down 70% this year, that's not helping things.
Bitcoin investors have taken it on the chin in more than once this year. That's an unbelievable decline. And it really gives some ammunition to the anti-Bitcoin crowd because, you know, early on in its inception and, you know, the marketing, so to speak, of Bitcoin, you know, it was called a digital currency, or the gold crowd, you know, the preservation of value.
Store of value.
Well, I don't know if you can attribute store of value to something that dropped 70% in 9 months. It remains to be seen. I think you're right. The story never stops giving. But with that kind of decline, there's going to be a renewed microscope on Bitcoin and blockchain technology and where it's going to fall.
All right, we do have to take a break. I want to mention next week we have a fantastic guest on this topic. Matt Hogan, who is Global Head of Research at Bitwise, will join us. So Bitwise actually pioneered the first cryptocurrency index fund, and they've also filed for a crypto index ETF. So we're going to go in depth with Matt on all of this stuff. And I've got to tell you, if you're not familiar with Matt, he actually came from the ETF space. I would say he's probably one of the most knowledgeable ETF experts out there. And there just aren't many people who can talk both ETFs and cryptos like Matt can. So be sure to join us for that on next week's show. All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk Pacer ETFs with Sean O'Hara, president of Pacer ETFs Distributors. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Nate and Jason in studio. We're now pleased to be joined by Sean O'Hara, president of Pacer ETFs Distributors. Pacer currently offers 15 ETFs with nearly $3 billion invested in those ETFs, the most popular of which are their Trendpilot ETFs. So these use trend following to determine whether or not to be invested in the market. They have Trendpilot ETFs covering large and mid-cap U.S. stocks, the NASDAQ, and then they have a European stock version as well. And Pacer also offers several other pretty unique ETFs, including a seasonal rotation ETF. They have ETFs focused on cash cow companies. They even have an ETF focused around companies treating military veterans well. And they'll actually donate a portion of the management fees from that ETF to veteran-related charities. A very interesting ETF lineup, and we're going to walk through a number of these with Sean, who's now joining us via phone. Sean, as always, great having you on the show.
Thank you guys so much for having us. We really appreciate it.
Sean, let's start with your Trendpilot ETFs, the largest of which is the Pacer Trendpilot U.S. Large Cap ETF, ticker symbol PTLC. So as of yesterday, all four of these ETFs were 100% in cash, T-bills. Maybe first describe how these ETFs are designed to work, and then I'd love to hear about the timing of the move to cash.
Sure. I mean, they all work essentially the same way. We like to refer to it as like a traffic light, green, yellow, and red. Green means go, yellow means slow down, and red means stop. Well, green means go to us is if the index itself is above its 200-day simple moving average, then we believe that's when the market's in an uptrend and we want to own stocks during those periods. If the index falls below its 200-day simple moving average for five consecutive days, 50% of the portfolio will go to T-bills. That's our slowdown position. That's caution. Let's see what's going to happen. And then from there, it can either go back into the market if it's just a quick correction, or if the long-term trend on the market changes and the 200-day moving average itself starts to go down instead of continuing to go up, we'll go to 100% Treasury bills and stay there until the trend reverses itself and the market goes back above its 200-day moving average. We think the appeal of these strategies is for investors who are long-term investors, but who don't necessarily want to live through the short-term pain that sometimes comes with being an equity investor, and that's those bear market cycles. Using the 200-day simple moving average just by itself, for example, in the financial crisis would have reduced the loss on the S&P 500 to about minus 6% as opposed to more than a 50% decline in the S&P 500. So we've designed these products to work in an ETF, and the wrapper itself is something that's very appealing because of some of the potential tax efficiencies you get. But people are using these strategies as a complement to their existing long-only equity strategy for a part of the portfolio that can help measure and manage some of the decline on the downside.
Sean, this is Jason Lenk. You touched on something there, that there may be some advantages, you know, subscribing to a momentum strategy within the ETF wrapper. I'll have a client ask me, why don't I just do it myself? You know, trade my own stock and bond ETFs and follow the rules. What's the advantage of doing it at the ETF level rather than at the account level?
It's really three things. One is cost. You know, being able to have it done automatically inside of an ETF, we get institutional level pricing on securities transactions, whereas the average individual would pay retail prices. And so, you know, part of the advantage you would potentially achieve over time would be erased by those additional transaction costs. Two is emotion. You know, rules are meant to be followed, and we follow our rules because we're followed as a passive strategy, which means that when the methodology says it's time to go to T-bills, we go to T-bills, even though we might feel like the market's going to continue to go up. And when we're in T-bills, we follow the rules again. When the market goes back above its moving average, we go back in because the rule says to, whereas an individual investor might be too afraid to go back in at that point. And then the third thing is that there are some tax efficiencies inside of ETFs with regard to the way that we rebalance the fund. We just rebalanced, for example, the large cap, all of four of the trend pilots, and we're able to do so without creating any capital gains distribution. So the tax advantages that ETFs possess that the individual investor doesn't, outside of a qualified plan, I should say, just to be completely accurate, but outside of a qualified plan, the tax advantages are an enormous difference. So you could theoretically do this yourself, but I don't think you'd have near the results that you would by doing it inside one ETF.
Sean, with a trend following strategy itself, it seems like one of the biggest risks is a whipsaw, right? Just getting bounced in and out of the market. And of course, we have seen the market spike up here recently. What's normal, or what should investors expect the ride to feel like on a strategy like this?
You know, I've spent the last couple of weeks here talking to as many investors and as many FAs as I could just to kind of check to see how everybody's feeling about where we are being in T-bills. You know, about a week and a half ago, everybody felt great about where we were because the market was going down 500 points a day. The market has rebounded here with the Fed comments that you were talking about in the previous segment and with the, you know, potential easing of the China tariff issue. But what most people tell us is that they understand why they own it in their portfolio, and it's a part of the portfolio that's essentially meant to go to the sidelines and own T-bills so that if we get one of these big declines, that they're not participating fully in that downdraft. And so the cost you pay, if you will, or the price you might pay in the short run is that you might have a little bit of what people might call whipsaw, where, you know, it might go in or out, or we may – you know, go out and then come back in a little bit of time and underperform for a little bit. But if you just understand the relationship between what it looks like when the 200-day moving average, for example, works like it's supposed to, you know, the example I gave you is out of a client-approved brochure that we have, the financial crisis down 6 versus down 50% plus. That's a massive difference. And so people are willing, at least so far, according to the folks we talked to say to themselves, I might give up 100 basis points or 200 or 300 or even 400 basis points on a short-term upswing here, but I'm willing to exchange that for what I get on the other side of the equation.
Well, and I think it bears emphasizing that with a strategy like this, with your trend pilot ETFs, you don't have to worry about making a market call, right? These ETFs make buy and sell decisions unemotionally. They're rules-based. You know, all that said, I guess I'm curious. You mentioned the Fed comments in the trade news out of China. Any quick thoughts on the market environment right now?
You know, my thoughts on the market are, well, first off, it's, you know, we're long into the tooth here on this current bull market cycle, and not all bull markets last forever. And so I'm not saying that we're entering a bear market cycle. I'm sort of a bull with a small case B, I guess. You know, things are different today than they were. You know, we have rising input costs in the form of a little bit of inflation, wage cost, rising interest rates, and potentially, you know, tariffs. We have expectations going forward that earnings will continue to grow, but not at the rate that they have been growing. So I would be sort of mildly optimistic going forward. But if I was an investor who was older and near or in retirement where, you know, a 30 or a 40% decline in the stock market would be a very challenging thing for them to deal with. I'd be starting to think about how to position my portfolio in a way where I might be able to minimize some of that exposure.
Our guest is Sean O'Hara, president of Pacer ETFs Distributors. Sean, going back to the topic of trade, earlier this year, Pacer actually launched the U.S. Export Leaders ETF, ticker PEXL. And the idea here is to own U.S. companies with a higher percentage of foreign sales. So I'm assuming positive trade developments would be a really nice tailwind here. I'm curious, what was the idea behind launching that ETF?
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of a, you know, every once in a while getting lucky is a good thing. We sort of got lucky, I guess, when, you know, when we had started to develop this product a couple of years ago. It wasn't based on any of the current discussion around trade and tariffs and all this other stuff. It was based on something that was very, very simple. And that is, if you look at the companies in the S&P 900 that have more than 50% of their sales outside of the U.S. compared to the 50% that have less than 50% of their sales outside the U.S., those companies that have more than 50% of their sales, U.S. companies have more than 50% of their sales outside the U.S., grow their earnings and their revenue faster than the others. And so we believe over time this should express itself long term in potentially higher returns for that group of stocks within the S&P 900. And so, you know, you all mentioned earlier in the intro, which was a fabulous intro for what we do. Everything we do at Pacer ETFs is a little bit different than, say, a traditional ETF that's just simply writing or creating low-cost beta solutions where people can, you know, fill in portfolio slices with inexpensive ETFs that will track a broad-based index. So in order for us to continue to survive and thrive like we have to be innovative, we have to be disruptive, and we have to be unique. And when you look at these broad-based indexes, we believe that there are certain things you can do in terms of screening them or eliminating names into broad-based indexes based on certain characteristics that should produce higher returns over time. And companies who have more than 50% of their overall sales from a fundamental perspective, at least from the fundamentals, have better fundamentals than those that don't. They grow their earnings, as I said, and their revenues faster than the other part of the index. And so we think that's worth owning.
Well, on your note on Pacer ETFs and innovation, another ETF that you launched earlier this year that I thought was really interesting is the Pacer CFRA Stovall Equal Weight Seasonal Rotation ETF. Great ticker, SEASON, S-Z-N-E. And what's interesting about this ETF is it will shift sector exposure depending upon the time of year. So I believe this is the old sell in May and go away strategy. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, we were very, very fortunate to be able to get introduced to the folks at CFRA and Sam Stovall, who is, you know, sort of a legendary guy. He's always on television, and he's really a very, very astute long-term investor. He wrote a little book called that was, you know, about Wall Street-isms, if you will, and one of them was this sell in May and go away idea, which people have been following for quite some time. Well, their research says that you really shouldn't sell in May and go away. What you should do is on certain sectors from May to October and then other sectors from November to April. So for the May to October calendar, you own consumer staples and healthcare, which are more defensive sectors. And, you know, a lot of the bad stuff tends to happen in October historically in the market, so you want to be more defensive. And then you own more growthy sectors from the November to April, which would be consumer discretionary, industrials, materials, and infotech. And their research indicates that, you know, that doing this over time actually would produce a higher return than just being a buy and hold investor on the S&P 500. And I will tell you that the short term numbers on this strategy have borne themselves out. I mean, the short term performance since we launched this ETF has been terrific versus the broad based benchmarks, which we all track. So, and again, you know, this is another one of those things that you could ask the same question on, you know, like, why don't I just do this myself? I can buy the sectors and just rotate myself. Well, it's the same exact answer that I gave as it relates to Trendpilot. You could, but you'd be paying retail transaction costs as an investor, and we get institutional pricing as an ETF. And as we get bigger, get better and better institutional pricing. But having it follow rules is the big thing. And then the last thing is the tax efficiency that you get with the inside of an ETF. So we're real excited about this particular ETF. It hasn't got off so as quick a start as we would have liked it to have gone, but the market's been kind of difficult here in terms of sentiment anyway. But we're real, real pleased to be able to be aligned with an organization like CFRA and to have access to these indexes to build ETFs on.
And Sean, to be clear, do you view that as a core holding in the U.S. sleeve?
I do. I think it's a core, you know, it's a I think investors ought to be thinking about their core equity portfolio holdings in three particular ways. One is beta. You know, there's a lot of research that says that, you know, active management and active strategies have a hard time producing excess return versus the benchmark. So you might as well own some of that just so that you can get the market's return. I think you should be trying to find some alpha strategies, and that's where we would put the season. It's in a strategy that we think over time will produce significant excess return versus the benchmark. And then I think you ought to be thinking about how do I protect my capital if we get into one of these extended bear market cycles. And you can actually build a very, very smart portfolio today by combining those three things in one portfolio. And that's the beauty, I think, in the innovation that's coming from the ETF business. It's growing rapidly because of the big players, but it's also growing rapidly because there's a whole bunch of folks that are finding unique and disruptive strategies like what we have that can help investors fit into their portfolio and build what we think are more robust, more smarter portfolios going forward.
Well, Sean, excellent note to leave it there on. As always, we appreciate you joining us on the program. Thank you.
Thank you guys so much for having us on. We really appreciate it.
That was Sean O'Hara, president of Pacer ETFs Distributors. And you can learn more about the Pacer ETF lineup by visiting PacerETFs.com. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk bonds and bond ETFs with ETF.com's Dave Nodig. This is ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Nate and Jason in studio. All right, before we bring Dave Nodig in to talk bonds, we looked at stock ETF returns earlier in the show. So let me quickly run through some bond ETF returns. And these are all year-to-date through the end of November. The Vanguard Total Bond Market ETF, BND, so this tracks the main bond benchmark, the Bloomberg Barclays Ag, that's down nearly 2%. And by the way, this benchmark has only had three negative years since like 1978, so this could be the fourth. The iShares 7 to 10-year Treasury Bond ETF, IEF, that's also down about 2%. Longer-dated Treasuries, so the iShares 20-plus-year Treasury Bond ETF, TLT, that's down over 7%. Looking at corporate bonds, so something like the iShares Investment Grade Corporate Bond ETF, LQD, that's down over 5%. High-yield bonds, J&K, they're basically flat. And muni bonds, so MUB, down just a hair, about a third of a percent. And then I'll also toss in bank loans, since we'll discuss those with Dave as well. So the Invesco Senior Loan ETF, BKLN, that's actually up 2%. And then quickly here, looking internationally, developed market bonds, so something like the Vanguard Total International Bond ETF, BNDX, which I should note is currency hedged, that's also up close to 2%. And emerging market bonds, PCY, they're down 8%. Jason, quickly, are any takeaways?
Well, brand new territory for fixed income investors. You know, we haven't seen market conditions like this. Really, two things to me, we're on these by Dave. What are investors doing with their fixed income allocation? Are they yanking it out of the market? Are they going long, going short? I would be curious about that. But also, hot off the press, a portion of the yield curve just inverted just the last day or so. So I really want to get into that and the potential implications.
Yeah, the yield curve's getting a lot of run right now.
Yep.
Let's bring in ETF.com's Dave Nodig.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com. The world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
People have been saying there are too many mutual funds since the 80s. For all the talk of smart beta, they haven't pulled in huge assets. The active managers are showing up in the ETF space.
Dave, you heard us talking returns there and Jason's question on flow. So let's maybe start with that, start with flows. I know there's been a lot of money going into shorter-term bond ETFs in particular. So what does that look like and what else have you been seeing?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question for the whole year we've seen flows into really very short-term funds like iShares Short Treasury Bond ETF has pulled in something like $10 billion over the course of this year. Their 1 to 3 year Treasury fund has pulled in six. These have become sort of top 10 asset gatherers in a year where the other thing people have been doing with their money is actually putting on a lot of risk. Things like IEFA, which is, you know, the, you know, Europe Asia Far East fund, those are the other big winners. So it's sort of an interesting barbell in investor sentiment where on the fixed income side, people seem to be looking at safety plays, this very short-term end of the spectrum. But in the equity space, they're taking risk.
Yeah, you mentioned the safety play. When you look at short-term bonds, do you think it's really that simple? I guess that and then just a combination of rising rates making these holdings more attractive?
Well, yeah, and certainly, you know, you mentioned the flattening and now potentially inverting yield curve. You know, if you don't have to invest 10, 15 years out to get a decent yield, why would you, right? Why would you take that extra duration risk, particularly when we are in a rising rate environment? You mentioned some of the negative returns we've seen in things like TLT, you know, a 20-year bond fund down 7% on the year. That's a direct result of rising interest rates. Being on the short end of the curve helps protect you from some of that.
All right, so you brought up this yield curve inversion. we didn't. Actually, we did before you did. What do you make of that? Because if you look historically, an inverted yield curve has preceded a recession, going back to like every time going back to like 1940, 1950. So what do you make of that? Is that something that you're concerned about?
Yeah, I think it's legit, right? Anytime there is a sort of, you know, a comparative stat like that where the inverted yield curve precedes a recession, which really has never been very wrong. We had a little bit of a hiccup there in maybe 2007 where maybe it flashed early. But it is legit to look at that and say, is this a sign that investor sentiment about the long-term prospects for the economy are really, really negative? That's what the traditional analysis of an inverted yield curve would say. The counter to that is there are a lot of institutional buyers in the world now that effectively have to buy certain dated treasury bonds. For instance, they have to always maintain a 10-year portfolio. If you're an insurance company and you're doing liability matching, things like that, and that sort of creates this endless bid to buy those securities when they come up for auction, that drives down their yield, and that's part of what creates this sort of weird market where some of the shorter-term paper, the stuff that's sort of 1 to 3 year, which tends not to be attractive to a big insurance company or a big pension fund, which is doing long-term asset liability matching, that's part of what creates this too. So whether this is a structural issue or whether this is that traditional economic sentiment indicator, I think remains to be seen, but it's worth being cautious.
Dave, something else I've noticed, if you look at shorter-term bond ETFs that are taken in money, a lot of them seem to be actively managed. If you look at ETFs like Mint, JPST, NEAR, is this a space where you think active managers can add some value?
I actually would sort of invert that and say I think it's a very difficult space to index, and I think that's really what you're seeing here. Most of the quote-unquote active management down here at the short end of the curve isn't sort of shoot-from-the-hip security selection. You know, I'm going to get this overnight paper and I'm going to buy that four-month due junk bond. It's actually managing a fairly tight mandate with pretty strict guardrails around things like credit exposure, about target duration and target maturity. And so I think active management is as much anything a matter of convenience and a recognition that it can be quite difficult to index this edge of the space.
You were talking about what institutional investors may be buying on the fixed income side, and if you look at the longer end of the curve, and this is actually a question we get quite a bit, but I'd love to hear your opinion on this. Is there any scenario where you think it makes sense to lend your money to the government for 30 years at 3.3%? Because that just doesn't seem like a very compelling value proposition right now.
Well, especially when you know, what, two and a quarter for doing it for a year.
Right.
Yeah, it doesn't make much sense at all, I think, for most investors, particularly in a market with rising rates, right? I mean, that's, you know, that 7% sort of punch in the face that the long-term bond investor took this year, that could happen again quite easily if we are in this continued rising rate environment. I mean, the bond market is pretty inexorable in its being driven by math. There's only so much investor sentiment can do to overcome the raw math of bond investing.
We're visiting with ETF.com's Dave Nottig. Dave, let's pivot and maybe talk corporate bonds. And something that seems to be getting a lot of attention right now is this increase in triple B rated corporate debt. So for our listeners, this is the lowest quality investment grade rating. It's just above junk bonds. And sort of the narrative out there is that if we had a recession or some sort of an economic blip, or I think even if rates just kept rising, which could make this debt more difficult to service, we could end up seeing a lot of downgrades in this space. And that in turn could spark a sell-off because there'd be too much junk debt supply out there, right? And so going back to institutions, some of them simply can't hold junk bonds, and so they would be forced sellers. ETFs tracking investment-grade debt, they would be forced to sell. Any thoughts on this? Do you see this as an issue?
Well, I think it's mostly an opportunity for investors. I'm actually a big fan of quote-unquote fallen angel strategies. One fund in particular, ANGL from Van Eck, that was sort of first to market with the strategy, and that is explicitly targeting those bonds that just slip below investment grade. As you pointed out, when a bond falls below investment grade, there's a whole bunch of folks out there that have to sell. They don't have a choice. That tends to put these things into oversold category. They tend to put out yields. They tend to have yields that are available that really are not representative of any increase in their probability of default. If you look at how the probability of default works in bonds, it's not like you go from, you know, triple B to double B and all of a sudden you went from a, you know, 1 in 10 chance of default to a 90% chance of default. It's much, much more gradual than that. And in fact, you know, the vast majority of defaults, 70% of defaults, happen at triple C and below, way down at the bottom of the junk curve. So I think people do get a little bit nervous about that that probability of default to an excess. So I think if you're looking at that triple B space, I'd actually be looking at those fallen angel strategies. There are a couple of great funds that do that now.
Dave, I want you to put on your tinfoil hat. I've got a conspiracy theory for you. with this mountain of triple B debt, you hear all kinds of things. Of course, everything on the internet's true, right? Is there any possibility that some of these rating agencies could be under pressure, political or otherwise, to maintain the status quo, to avoid some sort of forced sell-off? Or on the other hand, after 2008, where they were taken to the woodshed for not doing their job, they don't care. They're going to do what they want to do. Any truth to any of that or any thoughts?
Yeah, I tend to think the best of people as a default, and I don't think that there are people in back rooms smoking cigars deciding to manipulate the ratings for the benefit of the market. I tend to dismiss that out of hand. Now, I could be wrong. Stranger things certainly have happened in finance. But for the most part, I think it's smart to take ratings with a grain of salt, for sure. But I don't think we're in the midst of some vast conspiracy to manipulate the ratings in order to support the market.
Now, to Jason's point, though, I have read quite a bit that perhaps the ratings agencies are being too conservative after the issues they had in 2008, right? They're sort of sandbagging on the ratings. Dave, I want to go back. You were mentioning fallen angels. And I know I asked you earlier about active management in the shorter term or ultra short bond ETF space. So I think I know how you're going to answer this question. But what about in the corporate bond space, right? If you have an active manager who can maybe add some value by helping avoid, quote unquote fallen angels, or potentially picking out the quote unquote rising stars, the bonds that may see ratings upgrades, is there a case for active management here at all?
Well, you know, that has certainly been a story that people have told, that sort of smart bond pickers can find those gems that are, in fact, very safe but have very high yields and can sort of subvert the work of the rating agencies and be better at it than the raw indexers. It's an attractive story. Unfortunately, the math hasn't borne that out, right? The number of windows in which active corporate and junk bond managers have outperformed naive indexes is actually very small. Like, every once in a while, there'll be a quarter where they do it, but for the most part, you know, year in, year out, indexing still works in this space.
Well, and I have to point out, as smart as I like to think we all are, you much more than we, if we're all talking about this here on the program today, then everybody already knows about it, right? So the market's pretty good at pricing this stuff in.
Exactly.
All right, Dave, lastly, I wanted to ask you about leveraged loans. So an ETF like BKLN, the Invesco Senior Loan ETF. And for listeners unfamiliar with leveraged loans, these are floating rate bank loans made to riskier companies. But Dave, there's some talk out there about a quote-unquote ETF death spiral. So this would be where, I guess, redemptions in the ETF create selling in the underlying market, and you get sort of this negative feedback loop where supposedly the end result is the ETF blows up. And I think there are some who even question whether bank loans should be wrapped in an ETF to begin with. What's your take on all this?
So, you know, I don't think there's a death spiral, but I think it's important to point out that ETFs don't magically create liquidity for illiquid securities. They can give you access to securities that might otherwise be very difficult to access, but it doesn't create more buyers and sellers in a time of crisis. Bank loan ETFs, invest, most of their assets sort of at the B rating, double B rating and below. That's a very small part of the market. It's generally under 1% of all the bonds in the market have that kind of garbagey rating. And so you're talking about already a very small pool of potential securities. And, you know, in a world where we did see a rash of defaults at that end of the spectrum, where we did see a rash of selling, there's no guarantee there are going to be buyers there. Now, I think the ETF will simply come along for the ride, right? If there's a rout in triple C rated bank loans, that's going to hurt anybody who owns them. I think the important thing is for investors to recognize this is a very risky segment of the market. And yeah, you know, the spread versus, say, the treasury market over the last year between bank loans and that has been 4 or 5%. That's great, but recognize that every time the rates go up on these floating rate bonds, they actually get riskier. They get harder for the companies that have issued those notes to repay. So you look at the big holdings there, like a Burger King or a Caesars Resort, who tend to feature prominently there. Their financial situation actually gets worse as interest rates go up.
Dave, we have about 2 minutes left here. How do we kill this narrative, this ETF death spiral narrative? So whether we're talking leverage loans, of course, it's been said for years in the high yield space, even if we're talking about this triple B rated corporate debt and the impact that may have and the role ETFs play. Do you think it's just a lack of education out there? Because a lot of the people pushing this narrative seem to be really smart people, hedge fund managers, other people involved in the space. How do we kill this?
Well, I think it's just a matter of understanding sort of what these funds do and what they don't do. I think we look back at some of the failures we've seen in the mutual fund space, Third Avenue, a few years ago, which did get caught in a death spiral because they had redemptions that forced them to sell their most liquid securities, leaving them with a worse and worse portfolio. That doesn't happen in ETFs. It really doesn't happen in indexed ETF like something like BKLN. Even if everybody ran for the door in BKLN, it's going to track its index. It's going to liquidate a pro rata slice of all the things it needs to sell. Yes, if everybody's selling, those will go down, but they're not going to be exacerbating it through some sort of structural damage.
Dave, always excellent perspective. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That was ETF.com's Dave Nottig. Dave always does the best job out there of explaining, why these concerns are overblown around, ETF liquidity. At the end of the day, the ETF wrapper, as he said, doesn't magically change the risk reward profile of the underlying securities. It doesn't magically add liquidity to it. Whatever the ride you get in the underlying security is the ride you're going to get in the ETF wrapper.
That's exactly right. If there is a negative event in the fixed income space, high yield bonds or leveraged loans, they're not just selling the ETF shares, they're selling the individual securities. So it's
right.
All
everybody
the same
has, everybody's in the same boat. If you own the bonds directly or the loans directly,
same boat.
Or if you own a mutual fund that owns the loans or bonds directly, you're in the same boat. Everybody's dealing with the same market environment. So I that's why I was asking him. It just is amazing to me that this narrative still exists out there. And I guess maybe we just need to see, for better or worse, additional market dislocations, right, where people can see that the ETF functions the way it's supposed to. We had that in 08. We've had that in the taper tantrum, but maybe we just need to see it again. All right, podcasts of ETF Prime are available at etfprime.com, etf.com, iTunes, and Spotify. You can follow me on Twitter at Nate Geraci. Again, next week, we have a tremendous guest for you, Matt Hogan, Global Head of Research at Bitwise. We'll talk all things Bitcoin, crypto, ETFs. Again, Bitwise has filed for a crypto index, so this should be a fascinating conversation. And Matt knows both of these spaces, ETFs and crypto, inside and out. So we hope you'll join us for that. Until then, have a great week, everyone.